Race and Means Committee, Education Subcommittee, April 20th, 1999, here in Morristown.
We're going to start relatively early today. It's early for this committee. There'll be more coming in, but we have a lot to cover. So I think we can start and open the hearing on House Bill 5022. Stands for time.
It seems like we were just here.
We were. Groundhog Day. Yeah.
Today will be very different, I think, and I believe you'll find this both interesting, exciting, and challenging. When the board set out to re-engineer, redesign the system, one of the charges that we were given was to redirect a good deal of our energy away from the paper checking and the monitoring functions to one of opportunity brokering, as Tom Imason calls it, working with our private sector colleagues to try to get a sense of where Oregon was going to be just over the hill in terms of the economy and where we would need to be to serve that economy in the new century. And today you're going to meet some of those private sector partners as we attempt with them to glimpse the economy of the next generation. And our premise is obviously that an investment in the university system is an investment in the economy in a very direct and real way. We've just concluded some work done for us by Econ Northwest, a Portland company, looking at the economic impact of the university system. It was interesting how they did it. They set out to try and assess what would it take to replace us if we weren't here. And these are all in your materials, and I think you might find them, you might find it interesting. You'd have to come up with $1.5 billion in new spending and create 26,000 jobs, et cetera. So the economic impact is really quite significant. The next slide is one that I'm particularly proud of because it suggests that we double your investment, that the economic impact effect is a doubling of the investment that you make. If you take the class that entered in the fall of 97, the 17,000 new students who began with us that fall, and project out, as this organization has done, what the impact of their education is on the economy, it's really quite staggering. Alumni earnings, increased earnings of $3 billion, additional goods and services purchases, $1.3. This is over and above the fact that they've been just high school graduates. So the total impact, $4.4 billion. And then if you look at the next slide, $191 million in general fund that you typically have been investing produces a 130% increase in the taxes paid over the course of their lifetimes. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to invite Diane Vines, who is Vice Chancellor for Corporate and Public Affairs, who I lured away from a similar job in California. And she would like to have you meet some of our private sector colleagues and look a bit at the future and how we are involved in that.
Chairman, members of the subcommittee, thank you once again for allowing us to present today. I really should start by commending you for your endurance here. This is above and beyond the call of duty, isn't it? You've certainly been very engaging and attentive through this. I hope this morning will be something of an educational experience. We'd like to tell you some of the things that are going on in the state that in economic development activities that relate to higher education. And the vital link between higher education and a healthy economy in Oregon. To illustrate the importance of this link, we have four private sector representatives here this morning. I'd like to ask them to join me at the table. Don Kramer, he is partner at the law offices of Black and Helderline in Portland and is also a co-founder of the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative. Les Fahey, who is a partner at KPMG Pete Morwick in Portland and a co-chair of the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative Higher Education Work Group. Mike Consul, who is the publisher of the Business Journal in Portland. And Mr. Consul is also one of the gang of six that's planning the Oregon Bioscience Initiative. Catherine Mader is vice president of Mader Engineering Limited in Corvallis. And Ms. Mader is also a member of the Oregon Economic Development Commission. Allow me to provide some context for a few minutes. The other sessions have focused on the important role that the university system plays in preparing and developing Oregon's workforce. last night you, and I mean this morning, Joe talked about how the what impact we have on the dollars that are invested with our alums and our students. Now we'd like to examine how the university is working directly with leaders in business and industry to support Oregon's economy. Essentially, our goals in working together are threefold. One is to grow jobs in Oregon. The second is to expand wealth in Oregon. And the third is to support economic development in all geographic regions of the state, urban, rural, and suburban. As Tom Imason, our board president, indicated to you last week, Oregonians recognize this vital link between public universities and the Oregon economy. In that recent poll, this slide will show you, 92% indicated that a good higher education system in Oregon is vital if we're going to attract new businesses and industries to the state. And 82% said that the way to get ahead today is to have a college degree. With this background and with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn to Mr. Kramer at this point to talk about the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative. And you could follow along in your slides if you're not able to see the screen. So you'll see the slides in your handout.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Don Kramer, and I'm here actually wearing several hats today. I serve as Vice Chairman of the Governor's Council on Small Business. I am currently Chair of the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section and immediate past Chair of the Oregon Entrepreneurs Forum. It's with some pleasure I sit here today with you. I think back probably about 3 years ago when Catherine and I were sitting on a solutions team that Dave Frohmeyer was chairing on graduate education and the future of the Oregon economy, that we talked about a lot of the issues that you're going to see sort of coming to fruition today. It was a little over a year ago when I sat down with Joe Cox and Diane Vines to really talk about Oregon University System getting involved in a project called the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative. Oregon Emerging Business Initiative is a broad-based private sector initiative with several partners, both private and public, which the primary focus is to encourage the development and growth of emerging businesses here in Oregon. Being a lawyer that represents a lot of emerging growth businesses, a lot of times we think of these businesses in the high technology area, but in fact we sort of have developed a strategy that reaches both across technology and non-technology sectors. In addition to the Oregon University System, our other public sector partnership is the Oregon Economic Development Department. Also involved in this is the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section, representing about 1,500 lawyers statewide, the Oregon Society of CPAs, the Software Association of Oregon, the American Electronics Association, Oregon Biotech Association, and then the Oregon Independent College Foundation. The goal of OEBI simply is to make Oregon one of the top three regions in the world for emerging growth businesses by the year 2008. This was a goal that really was reached probably about a year ago at a leadership summit involving between 80 and 85 public and private sector leaders, including both Senator Hartung and I think Senator Nelson were involved in that process. Why are emerging growth companies important to Oregon? Particularly between 1992 and 1997, they created over 147 new jobs. Nationally, 70% of the new jobs were created by 4% of the companies, or these companies that we call gazelles. In terms of higher education, this is sort of what I see as one of the building blocks, and you'll hear shortly about one of the drums I've been beating is how do we tie sort of economic development policy together with higher ed policy. What's key when we did focus groups, particularly in terms of the study, what we found is that these entrepreneurs want more and better university resources, they want a more aggressive and talented workforce, and they need an actively funded system of higher education. And you look at hotspots such as the University of California system down in Austin, Texas, Boston area. Universities play a key role in sort of moving that forward. here in Oregon, I think Joe and Diane have done a good job through the by creating the Office of Business Alliances. Really, the purpose of this office is to build better relationships. Over the last year, I sort of count the numerous times that I've been with Diane and Joe in terms of connecting them with members of the statewide business community, and I think there is a real effort. Somebody who's lived here all my life in Oregon, I have seen at least OUS reaching out in a more direct sense to try to be more responsive to the private sector, and particularly in terms of some of these emerging businesses, which is an area that really there has not been that connection before. So I think to their credit, that's good. One of the small programs that is really a centerpiece of this is within the office, they create something called a knowledge exchange, where they have connected not only the universities within the Oregon University system, but also the 17 universities and colleges in the Oregon Independent College Association, as well as some community colleges. And the concept there is to sort of better tie those resources together to sort of serve the needs of the private sector, particularly on the emerging business side. So with that, Diane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like to ask questions as you go along, or would you like to wait?
Why don't we finish the presentation?
Okay. All right. Now, next, I'd like to ask Les Fahy to talk about emerging industries. These are industries that are already becoming a force in the state.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. In my role at KPMG Pete Marwick, I lead our practice working with the emerging growth businesses, and I probably see about 100 business plans a year in that capacity, and a lot of the plans we're seeing are basically new industries, new to Oregon, and I wanted to share just a few examples of some of those new industries. One is in the area of health informatics. These are companies that provide information on about healthcare options to consumers or help physicians share information. And some of the companies that are sprouting up in this area are Sapient Healthcare, Medicalogic, Salunet, and WellMed. Another area industry focused is bioscience, and there's about 30 companies in the biotechnology and medical device area. And there's likely to experience incredible boosts from recent scientific advancements, such as gene mapping. And some of the companies in this arena are Pangea Medical. It's a group that's spun out of Hewlett-Packard, and another one is NIAID Technology. The third area that you've heard a lot about is the Internet and e-commerce, and nearly every new company that launches today employs some sort of internet or e-commerce play. Probably at least 75% of the plans I'm seeing seem to have a focus in that area. Some of the companies you might have read about are WebTrends, which just completed an IPO, WebBridge, another company called 800.com that just raised $16 million of venture capital funding, which is the most ever raised in Oregon, RuleSpace, Plus Factor, and another company called Amicus Interactive, which is going to deliver degrees, higher educational degrees, over the Internet. The fourth area is flat panel display companies that create products for the visual display of information and entertainment, both software and hardware. And some of those companies are Pixelworks, Clarity Visual Systems, and Lightware. And all three of these companies spun out of another company here, which is an emerging growth business called InFocus Systems. All of these companies are growing fast, and they essentially have many of the same needs. And some of the examples of the growth in the industry are Medicalogic, which grew nearly 200% in 1998 in terms of employment. RuleSpace, which is typical of a lot of startups, they had four highly paid employees. Actually, they weren't so highly paid a year ago. But this year, they're up to 33 people. They've raised $5 million in funding, and now they're paying their people very good wages. And the third company is WebTrends, that grew 300% in 1998. And in 12 months, the company went from 32 employees to 91 employees, and they expect to have 110 employees by the end of June. These companies all have many of the same needs, as we said: access to capital, assistance with research and development, and also talented new graduates. And all three of these are affected by, directly or indirectly, by our higher education system. Just a couple quick examples of how Oregon's public universities are assisting in the growth of emerging companies are one company, Tech Labs in Albany, is an over-the-counter pharmaceutical company with mass merchandising and national distribution. And it has a working relationship with a faculty member of the Oregon State University Chemistry Department who now consults with the company on product development. Students at OSU are also involved in product testing and projects, and the company regularly hires interns and graduates. The second example is at the Digital Integrated Circuit Design and Test Laboratory in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at TSU, and a recent donation of $1 million in automatic test equipment from Credence Corporation in Beaverton has been a boon for the startups in the area. In a few months, a Portland Integrated Circuit Board startup company will come into the lab and test their chips on the TSU equipment. The only spot on the West Coast where this company can carry out this work. Without the lab, the company would need to travel to Southern California or build their own test lab at excessive cost to do this. This lab now has up to $2 million of donated equipment, and as it continues to expand, it's going to nurture the growth of many new companies here in Oregon. It's really impossible to predict which industries are going to generate the fastest growth, but it helps to remember that the $800 million sized Sequent Computer Systems once upon a time was a startup and was in an obscure area called parallel processing, and now it's a world leader in that area. If you want to invest in these rapid-growing, high-paying, and job-generating companies, and these are jobs, by the way, that pay about twice the average wages in the state, then the thing you need to do is keep improving higher education. Higher education is the key to creating knowledgeable managers. Higher education is the key to more rapid product development, and higher education and a cultural interaction with business is the key to increasing venture financing that these companies need, which is driven by the need for strong management capabilities.
Next, I'd like you to hear from Mike Consul, who's going to talk about one of those emerging industries, the bioscience and medical technology industry. And I mentioned he's one of the Gang of Six. There are six organizations working together. I'm lucky enough to be one of the members of that team, and Mike is doing that for the Business Journal, which has had a long commitment to bioscience and medical technology.
Madam Chair and subcommittee members, good morning again. My name is Mike Consul, a publisher of the Business Journal, as well as being a member of the Oregon Biostrategy Committee, on which I proudly serve with Vice Chancellor Diane Vine. Is that okay? Yeah, terrific. Thank you for your indulgence this morning, and I do mean indulgence because I am, if not the number one cheerleader, certainly one of the leading cheerleaders for this industry in the state. Our goal is very simple. As a Business Journal with our partners, and that's to build a powerful, nationally acclaimed bioscience and medical technology sector. We are committed to this industry because it is our belief at the Business Journal and with many of our partners that the key industries of the 21st century, that there's a twin pillar to that 21st century. There's two key industries, one being information technology, which the state is already quite strong, and the other being biotechnology, which we more broadly express as bioscience and medical technology. For our part, the Business Journal and the Oregon Bioscience Association partner on a couple big projects, one of which is sitting in front of you, the Oregon Bioscience and Medical Technology Directory, which, if you take a look at that, offers you quite a sketch of where the industry stands right now. In addition to that, we hold an annual Oregon Bioscience and Medical Technology Conference, which is slated for Friday, May 14th of this year. At last year's conference, among the things that we displayed was a technology transfer panel. Transfer from the academic world to the private world is key to growing this industry. Among the people who sat on that panel was Vice Chancellor Diane Vines. our efforts at the Business Journal and the Oregon Bioscience Association with our other partners led us to participate in the Oregon Biostrategy Committee and to develop a statewide strategy for building this industry. And if you look at the slide right now, there's several different categories that fall under the rubric of bioscience and medical technology. I'll run through them quickly, one being health and medical sciences. The powerful advances that we're seeing in medicine are the result very much of some of the bioengineering we're seeing today and some of the advances in high technology to have immediate translation to medical technology. A couple simple examples that we're all familiar with are magnetic resonance imaging machines, or MRI scanners, which allow us to peer into human tissue and diagnose as we've never been able to do before. We also see these miracle drugs coming to the foreground today, things ranging from Prozac to Propecia to Viagra. Those are some of the drugs that get a lot of the headlines, but in fact, there's many other very powerful drugs that have come to market, very effective drugs that treat things like ranging from cancer to strokes and heart disease. Medical technology, it is a cousin to the high technology industry, which we are already very strong in the state, which is why we're so excited about our potential for building this sector. When we talk about medical technology, we're referring to everything from the MRI machines I mentioned a little bit earlier, to pacemakers for the heart, to artificial organs, to corrective laser eye surgery. The life sciences, the use of genetic engineering and other biological processes to develop all kinds of treatments and cures for illnesses ranging from cancer and AIDS to Alzheimer and Parkinson's disease, and the list goes on from there. Let's say he mentioned health informatics, the use of information technology to achieve better healthcare outcomes. We already see this coming to the foreground. Let's mention a couple of companies. Another one that's in the directory that has made great strides is MedicalLogic. This involves everything from telemedicine to creating patient records that travel with us throughout our lifetimes and give us a much better healthcare outcome while reducing paperwork and the cost of healthcare. The environmental sciences, the creation of products that are environmentally friendly that don't pollute, such as fertilizers that have a much less impact on the environment. In addition to that, the development of microbes that we can then introduce to toxic waste sites that actually consume the toxic waste and turn it into a harmless byproduct, another very exciting component of this industry. Bioagriculture. We are now producing plants that are drought-resistant, plants that have tremendously increased levels of vitamins and nutrients. We're even producing plants that are genetically engineered to carry a gene that turns them into poison when consumed by their leading predators, and yet consumption by human beings is harmless. The important thing to remember about what I just mentioned in this industry, and one of the reasons I'm so excited about this industry for this state, is because it is it really augments so many of the industries that Oregon is already strong in, such as healthcare, such as high technology, and such as agriculture and the environment. This industry, our latest slide shows some of the growth of the industry. I would submit to you that what we're seeing right now is very much the tip of the iceberg. This industry is going to grow much faster than I think most people imagine today. If we were to kind of flash back 20 or 30 years, think about where the high technology industry was at that time. I don't think any of us would have fathomed the job growth, the wealth creation that we have seen from the high tech industry. Well, all the dynamics are in place right now with bioscience and medical technology for a replication of that. The business magazines that are out there are talking about this being the bio century. So we believe that the job growth, the company growth, the job growth we've seen today is nothing compared to what the state is capable of doing and what we've seen in other regions throughout the country. With regard to bioscience and medical technology here in Oregon, we are blessed with several assets, one of which is our simple geography. We are located between two of the world's leading biotechnology sectors and medical technology sectors, being the Bay Area and Seattle. The opportunities for learning from what they've done, to cooperate with those regions and create a biotechnology, medical technology corridor that I think it would probably be unprecedented in the United States is very high. Chief among the elements required to build this industry is a strong university system, strong on research and technology transfer. We know that. We've learned those lessons from Boston, the Bay Area, Seattle, and other regions, not only of the United States, but the world. If we turn to our partner organizations for a minute, one of which, of course, is the Oregon University System, system. Diane Vines, as I mentioned, is strongly involved in the Biostrategy Initiative. She also chaired a couple of our subcommittees. She's brought to bear the interest of the campuses around the state in the role that they can play in helping foster the growth of this industry and at the same time fortifying our state's universities. Oregon Economic Development Department has also played a very big role in the Biostrategy Initiative. The agency is also responsible for bringing in an entire international contingent to the upcoming Bioscience Conference on the 14th. We have representatives from European and Asian countries that will be there, not only as panelists, but as crowd members, to be meeting with our companies to talk about opportunities overseas, as well as what they can bring to Oregon. Oregon Bioscience Association, again, the business journal's partner in the directory in the conference, also playing a leading role in the Biostrategy Initiative. They also run an incubator that gives young bioscience medical technology companies their start in life. The Portland Development Commission, one of our sponsors of the Bioscience Conference and directory, and no wonder why they're so interested in it. It is one of the target industries of the city of Portland, and they have made quite a commitment to it. In fact, they are investigating right now the expansion of a downtown incubator so that we can produce more of these young startup companies. The Business Journal, as I mentioned, we produce the Bioscience Directory, the conference, we provide news coverage to the industry, and we're also pushing hard on this Biostrategy Initiative. Oregon Health Sciences University, again, a sponsor of both the Bioscience Directory and conference. It's one of the centerpieces of the statewide initiative that we put together along with the rest of the university system. The breaking ground on a new vaccine and gene therapy center. This is particularly important because it is expected to attract much more in the way of funding and research from the major pharmaceutical companies around the United States, right here to Oregon, which in turn, if the dynamic follows the dynamic we've seen around the country, is going to produce many new startup companies. In addition to that, OHSU has traditionally brought much great attention to the state because it does have an outstanding reputation. Other industry leaders, we have private sector participation. That's a very important thing here. This is not just a government initiative. It's not just the Business Journal involved here. We have private companies whose logos appear on that cover, and they appear will be at the Bioscience Conference. But in addition to that, we have many other players involved in this Biostrategy Initiative. These people lined up very quickly because they understand that this is where the future lies. They understand the potential of this state, and they're already putting chips on the table because they understand that this thing is going to pay off big for our state. And again, we believe it's one of the most important industries of the future. The goals with relation to higher education, the development of a world-class university system is front row center. We are very committed to achieving that. Increased technology transfer, one of the ways that we are already seeing some gains made, and that is the knowledge exchange that the Oregon University system has already gotten off the ground. Again, technology transfer key to this industry. More targeted educational programs. We know that several of the state universities are working together for a collaborative curriculum that would produce a bioengineering degree. So in summary, I would state that we in Oregon have many things going for us that lead us to believe that we can develop this industry in a very big way. But again, I want to emphasize the front row center. The lessons we've learned across the country and across the world is that this industry is driven by a powerful university system with strong research and strong technology transfer. And with that, I will again thank you for your indulgence, and I'd be glad to answer any questions when we've completed.
Thank you, Mark. Next, I'd like you to hear from Catherine Mader, and she is going to talk about a joint activity with the Oregon Economic Development Department and the colleges and universities of the state.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. It's a delight to be here today. I think covering some ground that may truly be a new initiative, certainly for the state of Oregon, and one that I think is quite innovative as I work across the United States in combining economic development with academic endeavors in a hands-on, on-the-field application of learning experience and technology transfer and knowledge transfer. We are talking about the development of an economic joint boards working group that is the first of its kind in the state of Oregon. We are proposing that the group be an establishment of many different individuals that combines both the academic institutions and economic development. I think the challenge here, in all honesty, is to not allow this effort to be just cosmetic in nature. I mean, when you partner with economic development, and I'm speaking as an economic development commissioner, and I think much of the dialogue that you've heard thus far has been a benefit relative to academic education and economic development that benefits the Willamette Valley Beltway. And what we're really talking about, I think, is the combination of research and technology that can benefit not only emerging business, but existing businesses in Boardman, Oregon, in Ontario, Oregon, in Lakeview, Oregon, and Klamath Falls, Oregon, equally as it benefits those companies that are getting their start and growing strongly within the Willamette Valley Beltway. So I think that becomes the real challenge between cosmetic activity and one that has hands-on application and really performance that's delivered to Oregonians relative to this effort. You can see the concept.
They appear will be at the bioscience conference. But in addition to that, we have many other players involved in this biostrategy initiative. These people lined up very quickly because they understand that this is where the future lies. They understand the potential of this state, and they're already putting chips on the table because they understand that this thing is going to pay off big for our state. And again, we believe it's one of the most important industries of the future. The goals with relation to higher education, development of a world-class university system is front row center. We are very committed to achieving that. Increased technology transfer, one of the ways that we are already seeing some gains made in that is the knowledge exchange that the Oregon University system has already gotten off the ground. But technology transfer key to this industry, more targeted educational programs. We know that several of the state universities are working together for a collaborative curriculum that would produce a bioengineering degree. So in summary, I would say that we in Oregon have many things going for us that lead us to believe that we can develop this industry in a very big way. But again, I want to emphasize the front row center, the lessons we've learned across the country and across the world is that this industry is driven by a powerful university system with strong research and strong technology transfer. And with that, I will again thank you for your indulgence. And I'd be glad to answer any questions when we've completed.
Thank you, Mike. Next, I'd like you to hear from Catherine Nader, and she is going to talk about a joint activity with the Oregon Economic Development Department and the colleges and universities of the state.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. It's a delight to be here today. I think covering some ground that may truly be a new initiative, certainly for the state of Oregon, and one that I think is quite innovative as I work across the United States in combining economic development with academic endeavors in a hands-on, on-the-field application of learning experience and technology transfer and knowledge transfer. We are talking about the development of an economic joint board working group that is the first of its kind in the state of Oregon. We are proposing that the group be an establishment of many different individuals that combines both the academic institutions and economic development. I think the challenge here, in all honesty, is to not allow this effort to be just cosmetic in nature. I mean, when you partner with economic development, and I'm speaking as an economic development commissioner, and I think much of the dialogue that you've heard thus far has been a benefit relative to academic education and economic development that benefits the Willamette Valley Beltway. What we're really talking about, I think, is the combination of research and technology that can benefit not only emerging business, but existing businesses in Boardman, Oregon, in Ontario, Oregon, in Lakeview, Oregon, and Klamath Falls, Oregon, equally as it benefits those companies that are getting their start and growing strongly within the Willamette Valley Beltway. So I think that becomes the real challenge between cosmetic activity and one that has hands-on application and really performance that's delivered to Oregonians relative to the effort. You can see the composition of members that we're talking about. I am particularly intrigued with the ability to work with the independent colleges and the community colleges because, again, I think that forces the issue of making sure that you've got that hands-on application of research and development in all the geographically regions, so throughout the state and not just within the urban areas. The focus of the working group, and again, I think this is just preliminary in terms of what we look at right now, but truly we're looking at working to grow Oregon's economy base, again, in terms of fair geographic representation across the state of Oregon. Increased funding for research and development, were I to continue in this level of working with this group, I think for sure I would really push toward deliverables that are, again, applied research and development, that have deliverables within a very short period of time, and that I can really illustrate, demonstrate performance in all areas throughout the state of Oregon. We're looking at cooperation with public and private funding. We say laboratories and overheads here. I would suggest that we change that to research efforts, because I think there are a lot of research efforts that are occurring within private business today that don't ever get registered on the income levels and the data sheets that you see in our company is one of them. We're not represented in the data that you see, but we do a great deal of research in the areas of natural research, for example. So I think truly there are a lot of innovative companies out there, existing and evolving existing companies, in addition to the emerging new businesses, that we really need to provide dual assistance to both ends of the scale as we apply research and development. And we do talk about matching private contributions. I can tell you one of the innovative things, all you need to do is go to Oregon State University to see one of the things that they have done is tied very nice collaborations with private nonprofit foundations in new arenas such as sustainable forestry partnerships, which does include research efforts that we think are having dramatic application across the United States and helping business out not only in the marketplace but in terms of new technology and development. And finally, we do talk about increase in knowledge transfer. I don't necessarily like the term technology transfer because I think, again, that perspective is right back up to the Willamette Valley Beltway area, and I think that we really need to pay attention to that technology transfer. And finally, not just to develop strategies, again, a little different than what the slide is suggesting, but I think the focus here always has to be on deliverables. So we're talking about implementing those strategies and implementing those within a demonstrated performance time that Oregon citizens can say this really is a partnership that's working and it's working on the ground level. How we grow Oregon's economic base, the next slide, shows you what I think is just one pathway. I'm not necessarily in agreement with this slide because I think it gives the impression that this may be the only pathway that you can go. And I would suggest to you that maybe the baseline of more research is definitely where it needs to be for research and development dollars, but again, in terms of applied research, I don't necessarily agree that that pathway has to lead up to new patents and licensing agreements, because I think a lot of research that has very good benefits to people and businesses don't necessarily require patents and licenses to be there. And so what we show you here is one pathway. It's a good pathway, but I would remind you that it's not the only pathway and the only thing that you should be judging performance level on. Oregon's industry, in terms of research and development programs, as you can see from the next slide, do indicate that we are below the national average and below the state of Washington, interestingly enough. There's another factor to that, that bar that I think you ought to pay attention to, too, and that's, and if you look at that closely, you'll see that Oregon actually is the only one of the three that is actually growing in terms of the employment of research and development dollars, whereas the national average is leveling out. The state of Washington does seem to be dropping. So we're not necessarily on the wrong pathway. We're just perhaps not on as an accelerated pathway as we need to be. And you can see, again, the target levels that we're really talking about. But again, I think the stress here is to make sure that we do the due diligence of paying attention to where that research is appropriated to. We look at all regions of the state of Oregon because I think there are some excellent research and development needs within many areas outside of the Willamette Valley Beltway that really deserve attention. And finally, the final slide, a little more self-explanatory here, maybe more graphic than anything else, but again, to illustrate that Oregon's universities really are fourth in the nation in federal contract and grant dollars per faculty, and there is a direct correlation to be able to pay attention to those kinds of grant dollars coming in from the federal level and the ability of economic development to become much more of a prominent position within the state. So with that, I'll say I think the effort in terms of the joint working group, I wouldn't be here if I didn't think it was a good idea, but I also want to indicate to you that I think we have a lot of challenges on our hands. I think one of the big credibility challenges is to make sure that as we put this together,
We do look at applied research. We pay attention to all geographic regions within the state of Oregon. And again, we constantly keep that focus and attention, not just on technology transfer, but on knowledge transfer. And I feel very comfortable with the fact that we are definitely heading in the right direction with this effort.
Thank you. Madam Chair, let me thank the panelists this morning. And you're seeing a group of people who work diligently to strengthen the state's economy and are very, very committed to it. And they've been particularly supportive of the role that higher education can play in all of those activities. We'd be very happy to answer any questions that you have. We probably have about 5 minutes before we need to turn it over to our other colleagues.
Representative Brown?
Kathy, welcome. We're happy to have you here. Kathy's from my district, and we're always proud of what she and her company have done. And they've been especially good about helping their workers advance within their company. They've done a great job. One of the things that concerns us is nationally and here, there is a tendency for us to go two different paths with higher wages for one set of folks and then another set of folks who are left behind. And so we have the haves and the have-nots. What do you think we need to be doing, Kathy, in this area to minimize that and to help those on the bottom come up and participate?
Yes, thank you. Good question, Representative Ross. And, you know, I think that some of that has actually been discussed today relative to increasing skill level of people in the technology field. We certainly see that within our realm of natural resource and the forest products industry, endemic within the state of Oregon, as is a national trend where lack of workers' knowledge and being able to understand computers, work with higher technology, even in the realm of what might be considered non-high-tech fields such as the forest products industry, continues to be a real problem. And we do see wage differentials based on those individuals that do know that technology versus those that don't. In fact, the area is so extreme right now. What we're seeing is a shift out of actually creating more jobs within the forest products industry because of the lack of worker skills to outsourcing that to someone else, many times outside of the state of Oregon in terms of production level, and having a finished piece come back into the state of Oregon for final distribution. So I think, again, that training of workers in all aspects of science and technology and mathematics really are a central point to making sure that we're able to kind of close that gap between lower-paying jobs and higher-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to respond, too, because in terms of the emerging business issue, I've spent a lot of time with Catherine and Brett Wilcox at the Economic Development Commission, and it is clear this legislative session that we need to serve those areas of the state beyond the Portland metro area. That's not to say that Portland metro and the valley does not need a plan.
Mm-hmm.
The next step for the Emerging Business Initiative, quite frankly, is we would like to conduct 5 regional forums around the state that would tie in Oregon University System, the private universities, but really have those sort of private sector driven. One of the things that we're struggling right now with the Economic Development Department in a positive fashion, nobody's ever identified who these emerging growth companies are, particularly in the outlying areas of the state. If we can start building those networks, get the leadership developed, what you have then is a strong infrastructure that's going to drive change in that process. And literally one of the things that excites us about Oregon University System's involvement is it's that collaborative effort, folks working together, as opposed to you hear the economic development folks talk one thing and OUS folks, the private university talk one thing. You got to get them all at one table and get the private sector to drive a process. So anyway, I think that's how I've got the perspective.
Henry Nelson?
I was happy to hear you comment on the other areas of the state, and one of the things about the model that has concerned us is that we are concerned about whether this will adequately support our rural colleges and universities, and are you satisfied with the way the model is providing support to those outlying institutions?
That's a good question again, Representative. I'm satisfied with the way the dialogue has gone thus far. I'm not sure that the perspective is as broad as I'd like to see, so I think a lot will be contingent on who those people are that become a part of that working group to make sure that you've got the strength of those individuals we do understand that there is, in fact, a great opportunity and a commitment and a mandate to make sure that the rest of Oregon is serviced as it should be.
Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, I think this is probably one of the most, or more important, probably maybe the most important panel that we may have before our committee. Because when I think they give us a vision of where we need to go, we're talking about maybe not how much money we're spending, but how we're going to spend our money. And that ties into what brought us to where we are, the agricultural businesses, going into high tech, how that combines, talking about businesses and income tax supporting our public services. Basic a vision of where we need, what we need to do. I have to give Kathy Diamond some credit for this because I read an article. No, I think, well, I don't know if it's in a business journal or not. Was it she the editor? What magazine?
Oregon
Business Day. And I read an article, and then she challenged the legislature to say, you know, why don't you guys come to the party? I called her up. That led me to Don Kramer and various other people. And so I have to admit that my philosophy has been greatly influenced by basically what you've done. We need a broader base for our economy, I think. I think that's what's going to pay public services. We need to include the entire state. We need to tie higher education into this. And I think it brings the message that everything's related in this whole process. And we can't think about higher education budgets or without thinking about other things. And I made a vote in last week, vote against the community college budgets because I thought it wasn't enough. And I had that same feeling that we have this problem of having X amount of dollars. That's probably not going to increase. And so something that my mother probably taught me, it's not what you do, it's how you do it. And so it's not where we spend our money, it's how we spend our money. And I think we ought to be spending our money in things with a vision like this because that's what's going to take us into the next century. That's not a question, but if you want to comment.
I appreciate your comments, Senator Nelson, and just wanted to add that information technology and biotechnology, the two key things about these industries that differentiate themselves from other industries is that when they make advances, they affect all other industries. That's not true of most industries. Every industry is more efficient today because of high technology. That's why it's a revolutionary industry. Biotechnology is another revolutionary industry that's going to take dozens of industries to make them more powerful, more efficient, and allow us to do things that we've never been able to do before. That's why it's so important that those two pillars be really the bedrock of our 21st century economy, because what we already have, it will make stronger, it will augment all of that. At the same time, if we're going to compete, those pillars aren't there. Other states have already developed it or are working on it, and it's a race. The race is on. We've got the tools in place. I just, absolutely, this is connected. That's the key thing to remember and why those two industries are the most important for us to set our focus on. We're not excluding anybody by doing that. That's the key thing.
Thank you. Real quick.
No, I was waiting.
I apologize for missing the panel, but a question. We have put money through the Oregon Growth Account to try to address some emerging business issues. Was that part of the discussion this morning?
Randy, not really. We didn't get into it. We really focused on higher ed day. One of the work groups focused with the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative is the Capital Resources Group, and we've actively worked with Keith Barnes and Butch Swindell to sort of get the $21 million placed that I think will have a positive impact on Oregon. The other thing that we didn't talk about today that is equally important is there's a whole effort underfoot to sort of develop Oregon's angel investment base. In Portland, we started out with a very loose-knit group. We now have a group of probably 50 to 60 angel investors. Again, what we want to do is go around on a region-by-region basis, have regional angel groups that can then be connected sort of statewide. But again, that's sort of been the work plan for the next sort of 18 months.
Thank you. Since we're short of time, we would be happy to provide much more information about any of these initiatives to any of you. So I'll hang around, and if you want to give me, you know, just the notice to what you'd like to have for more information, since we covered a lot in just a short period of time. Thank you very much for letting us be here today, and I'd like now to introduce Vice Chancellor Anvil, who will take us into the next part of the program this morning.
Thank you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Bill Anslo, and it's my privilege to introduce the Chancellor, who's going to kick this off a bit, and as well, President Paul Ridger, Van Zow, and Phil Creighton, who are going to talk a little bit about the influence of this budget and budget model on their particular institutions. We've heard a little bit about that from presidents early on in the session. And we will have to talk a little bit about numbers at this point, and that's my main task. So the first chart I asked the, you to look at is the chart in your book called Comparison Options. Very significant numbers, and the type is much too small to see. So I think it's best if you go to the back of the book under the economy, and you should it should flip up right after the slide charts that if you just saw. The first one is called Comparison Options. These are numbers that that deal with the general fund above the current service level. Assumption is the current service level is in place. And they're here for your information to compare the numbers that relate to the governor's recommendation that's before us, and we've just spent 4 or 5 days covering the aspects of that. The so-called Senate leadership recommendation, that's a number of 100 million, three. And the Oregon University System budget recast number, the original request number of 116.3 million, was meant to fund the model plus maintain a tuition freeze at the undergraduate level, which required $15.3 million. And subsequent to the submission, the board, the State Board of Higher Education, has dealt with what would happen at $116 million and has rearranged some of those numbers. I think just to go try to go fairly quickly through it, the tuition freeze is applicable under all three plans, $15.3 million. The second policy packages area, recapitalization, we've identified three components of that, investment in the new model, faculty recruitment and retention, which the governor included in his recommendation, would stay the same across all three. And then if the legislature were to take up the budget at the Senate leadership level, the impact in terms of new engineering investments, the current service level supports the 504 at the current biennial level, there would be additions there. And then the issue of enrollment growth at the governor's level, the board has tentatively set, and these are just general fund numbers that tentatively set $5 million. If the $100 million were possible, that number grows to $13 million. And then in the recast budget, it's up to $16 million. And then I recognize that that the current bill that's under consideration in this committee does not include the statewide public services, but there was, as part of the board targeting, at the $100 million level and at the $116 million level, consideration of expansion of activities in the statewide public service. I'd like to spend another, these are all very significant numbers and just, and deal essentially with the increment. I would like to spend an additional couple of minutes before we hear from the president.
Can I just interrupt you for a moment?
I just hope that during the presentation, I don't want Bill to interrupt you now if we plan to discuss this, but I would like to know the difference for enrollment growth in terms of what 5.4 buys and what 13 million buys, so we know. Have some good idea of what the difference is.
Madam Chair, Senator Charles, I think I can answer that from memory. It what it would buy would be approximately an additional 1,000 to 1,300 students beyond the governor's recommendation level, particularly at the undergraduate level.
Well, students that we anticipate coming anyway, or students that are projected, or what?
We are, there's two events, Madam Chair, Senator Schroeder, two events going on. One is that we normally look at the high school graduating population, our retention rates in the campuses, the number of transfer students we'd like to serve in community colleges, and all of those numbers we are predicting would have significant improvement from what we've seen, say, in the last decade. So those are what we call an enrollment demand consideration.
You see, the students out there, you need money to handle them, and the difference is the amount that's there to handle students that are likely to be there.
Likely to be there. They're not yet in the classroom, but they're looking on the admission sheet. What we don't know is whether the students that have applied to Campus X might also have applied to Campus Y, but we're showing very strong demand. Our pattern, I looked at the pattern going back to the mid-80s, our strongest year-to-year change was about 3.8% in that entire time period, and it was up in one. And then we had experienced years in which it was zero growth, and in some years it was actually a decline as a result of reduction in programs and cutting of funds on a year-to-year basis. We are predicting for the undergraduates alone over a 5.5% increase over the current level into the new year in terms of what that enrollment growth is, and then another 4% or so, 4.5% from our predicted year to the second year in the biennium. So over a 10% anticipated growth. These numbers are developed by our Central Institutional Research Office. We then go out to the campuses and ask them what their reactions are. Those numbers change over and over again. Now, what we've done in terms of the budget itself is to deal with what we think are the capacities, given certain levels of funding, that would serve as close into the new funding model as possible. At each level, it's, the way the hydraulics works is if you serve more students, there's a limited amount of funds, then you have to decrease the cell values, if you will, in terms of making the total budget fit with which underneath whatever capacity is there. I think the presidents themselves can talk to this a little bit, but that's sort of a general sense. And what we're trying to do at the governor's level is serve at least an additional 1,300 students. At the Senate level, we could expand that to say 2,300 or some number on that order. And then at the OUS level, perhaps serve another 500 or 600 beyond that. But the demand is very, very strong as the numbers are showing up right now, unusually strong demand. If I could, Madam Chair, for just a minute, and I won't try to go down through every one of those. The little tag on the upper right-hand quarter identifies this chart as Governor's Recommended $73 million E&G.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that I did want to talk about when we do get along here and perhaps when the presidents take over is to discuss what we do when we do reach that point where we've capped the support, if you will, and what we do when we punch beyond that, if we could.
I think that would Madam Chair, Representative, I think that will fit with some of the discussion the Chancellor wants to give and as well as the others. I just want to make a couple of points, that when we talk about the budget of the higher education system, we have to think about just the general fund, and there's significant support increase in the general fund in the budget under all these scenarios. But we also have to recall that there's much of the support from the campuses comes from income. It's called other funds, essentially tuition and fee income, also recovery in terms of indirect costs. And what we're doing, if you look at the revised base level, we are now including continuing education and continuing education tuition as a part of what's the new model will be in terms of support for the campuses, just as the fall, spring, and winter term, so that we have to revise the base to include that $19 million. Then we go down through, if you look on the right-hand side, make a series of adjustments as both the LFO, Steve Bender has reported, and the DAS have reported in terms of the adjustments to this budget dealing with community college partnerships, certificates of participation. And then I call your attention to the policy packages. And the first one is the $15.3 million for the tuition freeze. While that's an increase in state funding, it's offsetting what otherwise would have been a tuition increase, so that the impact in terms of program activity remains the same. It's just covering costs with state tax funds that otherwise would have had to be a tuition raise, and therefore you get a zero in terms of the impact on the program. The recapitalization, $47 million and $5 million under the governor's budget, and then as we talked, the growth, $5.4 million in terms of the state general fund, but that would be accompanied by $3.4 million of tuition funds, so that there would be $8.8 million for the campuses to spend based on the governor's recommendation. The last point I would make on this chart is that the total overall impact, while there's large percentage increases in general fund, would be about 5.5% of program growth and other activities beyond the total funds that are available in the revised base. I won't go through that in detail, but just ask you to flip the next two charts. That you received the same information in terms of what the $100 million the Senate leadership recommended would be, and then the try to go down through every one of those. The little tag on the upper right-hand quarter identifies this chart as governor's recommended $73 million E&G.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that I did want to talk about when we do get along here, and perhaps when the presidents take over, is to discuss what we do when we do reach that point where we've capped the support, if you will, and what we do when we punch beyond that.
I think that would Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I think that'll fit with some of the discussion the Chancellor wants to give, and as well as the others. I just want to make a couple of points, that when we talk about the budget of the higher education system, we have to think about just the general fund, and there's significant support increase in the general fund in the budget under all these scenarios. But we also have to recall that there's much of the support from the campuses comes from income. It's called other funds, essentially tuition and fee income, also recovery in terms of indirect costs. And what we're doing, if you look at the revised base level, we are now including continuing education and continuing education tuition as a part of what the new model will be in terms of support for the campuses, just as the fall, spring, and winter term, so that we have to revise the base to include that $19 million. Then we go down through, if you look on the right-hand side, make a series of adjustments as both the LFO, Steve Bender has reported, and the DAS have reported in terms of the adjustments to this budget dealing with community college partnerships, certificates of participation. And then I call your attention to the policy packages. And the first one is the $15.3 million for the tuition freeze. While that's an increase in state funding, it's offsetting what otherwise would have been a tuition increase, so that the impact in terms of program activity remains the same. It's just covering costs with state tax funds that otherwise would have had to be a tuition raise, and therefore you get a zero in terms of the impact on the program. The recapitalization, $47 million and $5 million under the governor's budget, and then as we talked, the growth, $5.4 million in terms of the state general fund, but that would be accompanied by $3.4 million of tuition funds, so that there would be $8.8 million for the campuses to spend based on the governor's recommendation. The last point I would make on this chart is that the total overall impact, while there's large percentage increases in general funds, would be about 5.5% of program growth and other activities beyond the total funds that are available in the revised page. I won't go through that in detail, but just ask you to flip the next two charts, that you receive the same information in terms of what the $100 million the Senate leadership recommended would be, and then the recast Oregon University system would drive that up another just about a little over a percentage point. And then on the next chart, you get a comparison in all that detail in terms of the impact on the CSL, 5.5% at the governor's level, 8.3% at the Senate leadership level, and 9.86% on the original OUS request. So the differences in terms of our total operation between the governor's recommendation and the Senate leadership recommendation is about 2.8% in the total operation. And I just thought that you, even though I was trying to stay away from the numbers, I thought that that set a framework for the differences in how the board would face allocations to campuses. I know there's been a lot of discussion about the impact on the small campuses, the regional campuses, and each one of these makes a difference in terms of both the regional campuses, the small campuses, as well as the large campuses and the impact on research and graduate education. Stop at this point and ask President Phil Creighton, President of Eastern Oregon University, cover some points in terms of...
I'm only going to make one comment because I think it's important that you hear from these folks who come at great distance to hear. And by accident, they happen to be three of the institutions which are most affected by the model in many ways, and three about which you have been concerned about are they at the appropriate level, are they at a level that the gate sees and have a fair chance to succeed. I want to make one comment about enrollment. Even in the midst of the worst years of Measure 5, we did not turn away academically qualified Oregon kids. I was through that. I'm probably almost just about the only surviving president who went through that period. We didn't turn away. At U of O, OSU, Southern, we didn't turn away Oregon residents here. But they were academically qualified. We lost a lot by pricing them out in that one big jump. But we found ways to make work. Phil?
Chairperson Menace, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I really appreciate the chance to come and talk to you about small institutions and Eastern Oregon University specifically. My name is Phil Creighton, and I'm president of Eastern Oregon University. This past couple months, you've been subjected to an overwhelming amount of information about higher education, and I apologize by saying that I'm going to continue that onslaught this morning. However, what I want to do is to change the focus slightly and to talk to you in a more positive direction about what the benefits of funding the Oregon University system at the higher levels would be, and specifically what the increased funding would mean to the smaller institutions of Oregon. We're going to be talking about the proposed figure of $100 million as the target figure for this funding increase. And these will be the amounts of dollars I'll be talking about as program influences at these small institutions. The small regional institutions of the universities, in addition to Eastern Oregon University, of course, are Southern Oregon University and the Oregon Institute of Technology. Within their institutional missions, these three universities provide a full range of programs and services to the regions that they serve. In the case of Eastern, for example, we are the only baccalaureate institution in an area of geographic size equal to Pennsylvania. At EOU, we have about 2,000 on-campus students and about another 900 students we serve through distance education. To effectively provide a full array of programs for these students seeking our services, we have formed collaborations with all six other members of the Oregon University System, with five community colleges in Oregon, and we are the charter member of the Western Governors Institution for Oregon. So we've been trying to be as entrepreneurial as we possibly can to provide the same services that other institutions, because of the larger size, are able to provide more easily. Because of the relative size of our overall budgets, and particularly the state appropriations to those budgets, specifically EOU, OIT, and SOU are differentially affected by the different funding levels at the new budget model. And we're talking about three different funding levels, the 73, the 100, and the 116. Particularly when you consider that regardless of those funding levels, there are a number of unfunded mandates that have been added to those figures after we had first entered negotiation. And I identify five of these unfunded mandates as we look at these figures. My good friend President Reno identifies these as icebergs in the water lurking in front of the institutions as they move down the stream of higher education. Any decrease in the funding level below $100 million then proportionally impacts the smaller institutions because our budgets are small. If you reduce the amount of money overall, then, of course, the amount of money going to the smaller institutions proportionally has a greater impact. What we are requesting, and what funding at the $100 million level will provide, is a chance to compete on a level playing field. What we want is an opportunity to succeed as Oregon universities. The question is, if you commit these dollars, what will we do with the money that you provide us? The majority of the new dollars at Eastern, for example, will be used to recapitalize our program areas. We all want to be the very best institution we possibly can be. My vision for Eastern, for example, is for us to lead the Oregon University System in retention rates and graduation rates. I would like to have all of our students, for example, to participate in internships and undergraduate research opportunities and international learning experiences and to return something of themselves back to the community through service learning. I would like all those activities to be completed before they graduate. We would like to grow in size, to go from a small critical size where we are to a size that's more sustainable. And so I look at a growth of about 50% over the next 5-7 years. And through the increase in quality of the programs, I would like Eastern to be Oregon's selective undergraduate institution. With additional partnerships with other OUS institutions, we would provide an expanded list of offerings to our region. Particularly important would be programs that would be stimulating economic development within Eastern Oregon. With additional funding, we would be able to establish a small strategic reserve, in fact, that we could respond to the changing face of higher education and be flexible with new opportunities. In a nutshell, Eastern Oregon University would use the money for three very simple, very transparent reasons. We would use the money to improve quality, we would use the money to improve access, and we would use the money to improve service. If you will, please permit me a personal reflection that would hopefully illustrate our current situation at Eastern Oregon University. I grew up on a dry land wheat farm in Colorado. Looking back, like many small farms in the 50s and the 60s, we had best a marginal level of existence. But my dad loved that farm. There were many times that he would take me and my brothers and I out around the farm and talk about his hopes and his dreams for that particular area. Invariably, those talks with us would end with, if only. If only we could buy the Swansons' property. If only we had a wetter winter. If only the prices would go up. I didn't fully understand as a kid all that he was talking about, but in this last year as president of Eastern Oregon University, I've come to feel what my father must have felt at that farm. Eastern is a wonderful university. It has an excellent and very, very dedicated faculty. Its staff are the best I've seen. And its students, I wouldn't trade for anybody throughout the United States. There is so much potential at Eastern Oregon University. We could be the very best. Yet we truly do have currently a marginal existence. And I find myself at night, often my heart aching for this institution, and I find myself asking and saying to myself, if only. I come the day before you to talk about the benefits of these new resources to the institution, because if only we could obtain these resources, we can be the best institution for the money in Eastern Oregon. This budget model is not perfect. It doesn't provide all the answers. It differentially rewards some of the larger institutions compared to the smaller institutions. But it is an important start for us at Eastern. It provides us an opportunity and incentive for growth. We can bring in more students and bring those tuition dollars in. We can provide new programs and encourage economic development within the region. What I encourage you to do is to join with me and to make those dreams that I have for Eastern a reality. And I respectfully urge your full support for the funding models that we've talked about today at $100 or $116 million. Again, I really appreciate the opportunity to come and see you this morning. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have now or wait until later. Whatever your preference, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson?
Yes, thank you. I tested your distance learning staff the other day, and after hearing about your program, I contacted them, and they got back to me very, very quickly, very efficiently, so be proud of that sector.
I am indeed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Maybe each of you could describe, because I think one of the things the panel needs to better understand is the request for $73 million, $75 million, and what the difference with your institution would be if you didn't fund it $100 million.
Representative Edwards, basically we can go through the numbers, and if we look at the governor's amount, we would approximately see $300,000 at Eastern Oregon University, which I'm grateful for. And that was what we were thankful before we began the actual discussions of some of these unfunded mandates that were coming on. Since we've received that $300,000 pledge from the governor, there's also been the iceberg of faculty salaries of about $200,000 at Eastern Oregon University. There is the opportunity to fund OPEU settlement. There's PERS. There's PEB. In addition, the system requires a enrollment reserve as we begin this new funding model. As a consequence, then, we would need additional subsidies beyond the $300,000 that the governor has pledged to begin an even spot in the fall.
Just to understand, but you just described the things that you said were unanticipated when the budget was being developed.
Correct.
And you know, to make yourself hold, it's the $100 million or less?
At $100 million,
distributed, I guess, under that way of
at $100 million, we would obtain slightly over $400,000 at Eastern. And after these mandates are finished, we have about $150,000 for use of new programs.
Chair Menace, members of the committee, my name is Martha Ann Dow, President of Oregon Institute of Technology, and I too would like to express my appreciation for the opportunity to speak with you today. My theme is going to be strengthening technology education in Oregon is a wise investment. And OIT, being one of the smaller institutions with a current student enrollment of about 2,600, populated both in Klamath Falls campus and also at the Portland Metro Center and in Beaverton, and a singular program also ongoing in Bend in collaboration with the Higher Ed Center there. We find ourselves unique by design. We function as a regional in the southern part of the state on the other side of the mountain from southern Oregon, but we also have statewide responsibilities. And our mission is, as the only public institute of technology in Oregon, to provide access to those programs throughout the state. I would like to think that in the area of the programming you've just heard by the business and industry representatives on the previous panel, that OIT plays a very functional role in that area of economic development, both in the southern region as well as in the Portland metropolitan area. Our perspective in terms of delivering technology education, I think, comes from something I'd like to have you vision, and that's a vision of laboratories full of students engaged in manufacturing, engineering, and electronics, computer hardware and software, in manufacturing and industrial management, and in several health technologies. All of these programs require sophisticated equipment and capitalization in order to not only serve the population of students in degree completion programs that are in industry, but new students entering as freshmen. In the slide that we're talking about now, I'd like to say that the new model is responsive to the citizen and industry needs and also provides accountability. That's two major strengths. These strengths are OIT's strengths, and philosophically, OIT would fit this model like a glove. It also provides incentives for programs in demand in high technology and health-related technologies, and if adequately funded, this will strengthen OIT's ability to keep abreast and to keep ahead of the curve in these areas. The new model would allow us to provide more access to bachelor degree programs in technology education throughout Oregon. If adequately funded, OIT would have the resources to develop additional bachelor's degree completion programs in high-demand areas for Portland and in the new partnership on the Oregon coast. These partnerships that we currently have with many community colleges and our other sister institutions will facilitate this process. It is indeed a continuum in education. It is K through 16, as Dr. Risser points out. And for us, our Opt for Co-op program is an intensive way to feed a pipeline into the demand areas for the workforce and the economy of Oregon. We are not just a technical school that provides only opportunities in a few high-tech areas. But we are a school that has a comprehensive curriculum inside it to also provide flexibility in other programs for transfer students to move on into some of our partners. I would like to point out to you in a second slide that the need for a healthy state investment base so that the cells are properly funded is the very essence of this model for OIT and for some of the rest of us that are so encouraged by the opportunity to engage in this. We will find that this new model has the opportunity to fund the cells in the high-tech programs at a certain level that will adequately provide the capitalization that we need. But there's tremendous impact if we reduce some of these for the high-tech cells for the science technology majors. And if you see on the slide, about 30% of OIT's enrollment is in high-cost programs. This model will fund those if the cells are adequately funded. The impact of just a 10% reduction in that is major for the science technology majors, and this would impact OSU equally as well. A difference of, if you're talking about an English and a literature major, freshman, sophomore level, of model resources available at about 2,900. The impact there of reducing that is only about 10%, which is 290. In the case of reducing the high-tech cells, it's as much as $1,200. So what I am asking you for is to look carefully at the opportunities that the funding at $100 million and even above would do in order to adequately fund the cells. Technology in both health and engineering are vital to the future of Oregon. Specific opportunities for OIT, as my colleague, President Bill, has recently told you about, would include being able, at the $100 million above CSL level, to provide the instructional equipment, the reserve for both enrollment and also capitalization to us. It would allow us to expand and offer laser optics and information technology bachelor's programs in Portland and add some new programs in applied science to broaden our opportunity with community college articulation. It would also help us provide infrastructure to continue to develop a technology center for professional development, continuing education for the industries of Oregon. And of course, at this level, the recapitalization for the instructional equipment, as well as the opportunity to serve more students, is key to us. I would like to simply sum up and say to you that this is an entrepreneurship model. It needs to create adequate reserves, risk capital, and also transition capital. OIT is not an average technology institution. It's well above our average with all of our programs well accredited. However, we want to stay there. Thank you very much.
Before turning the close from the principal here, let me just make sure that we understand, and have always understood, that at all three levels, there's a strong commitment to the concept, to the model. The difference is how much of that can be done this biennium versus how much has to be deferred to a second biennium. And that's been understood by us from the beginning. It's not a difference of opinion over the concept itself or the model or the direction, but rather how much can happen this biennium versus that.
Actually, so Mr. Creighton, just at the end of your testimony, I wanted you to clarify something for me. Representative Edward was asking me the impact of the governor's $75 million addition and Senate leadership's $100 million. And tell me if I got this right. You said that at the $75 million level, Eastern Oregon would receive an extra $300,000, but because of some of the unfunded mandates, have been cut that $300,000 from all those costs. When you were asked about the Senate leadership's $100 million, I understood you to say that was an extra $400,000, which would allow for $150,000 for new programs. So that didn't quite seem to jive with me, because it would appear that you needed $250,000 from that answer to cover your mandates. Actually would put you at $50,000 under the $300,000 the government proposal. Could you clarify that for me?
Yes, sir. That was a per annum cost, first of all, remember, and that we were looking at the tuition dollars that would be allowed to come in besides the state appropriations. And so at the state funding level of the Senate leadership money, we'd have additional tuition dollars to be able to work with to buffer some of those additional losses.
Because you have more positions?
Well, we fund tuition growth at a higher level under the Senate leadership model.
Okay. Got it.
Chairman Nunes, members of the subcommittee, my name is Paul Richter. I'm president of Oregon State, and I'm regretful that I have all of 4 minutes to make the points that I wanted to make. I had a wonderful story to tell you this morning, but let me just focus on the technical issues to make sure you understand the crucial ones. I'll make three technical issues. The first has to do with the funding level, and in particular the funding level at the governor's level, the $100 million and the $116 million. The key point for an organization like Oregon State University is the very high proportion of our programs that are in high cost. And that if you think about the model, you'll remember that at the lowest level, the liberal arts level, the funding in the cells are something like $2,900 per cell. And if you look at the right-hand level, at the level 3, the numbers get to be 900, 700, or 1,200. The total number of student credit hours in all of OUS at Oregon State in level 3 is almost 40%. What that means is almost 40% of the student credit hours at level 3 at Oregon State. And so if you reduce the funding of the model even 10%, it's a reduction of maybe $2,900 at level 1. But as you just heard, at the top level, that is level 3, that's something like $1,000, $1,200 for every one of those students. And Oregon State can't stand a funding level less than $100 million. We have this year, this biennium, we have 1,000 more students, nearly 1,000 students who are not in the formula. Our projected increased freshman students next fall at this day is an additional 586 more students. And so Oregon State simply can't manage if it's not funded at the 100 million level just because we can't reduce those large cells because of the high cost of our programs. And we have 40% of those at Oregon State. You have to understand that. So it has a huge impact on Oregon State if it's not funded at the 100 million level. Second point is that Oregon State is, as a Carnegie One research university, it's the only one besides the University of Washington and all the Pacific Northwest. I can give you a very quick story why research funding from the state is important, and it turned out to be in the paper this morning that Representative Loss would have seen. There was a story about research at Oregon State which has to do with reducing bone density in women. That project was funded by the federal government. The federal government did not fund, however, how to export that information around the state to help women who have this difficulty. It's a way of not only saving bone density mass, but actually increasing it. The university said that's such an important research result that it ought to be shared with hundreds or thousands of women, and so the university has invested money to make that set of results available in a program around the state. That's what's so important about research, and that's an example of why we need to have funding in this model for research. The third and last point I'll make is that when you think about businesses, businesses invest when they make changes, when they respond to new programs. These universities are trying to respond to new programs with funding which is below the national average, which is below the regional average. You have a sheet in front of you which lays that out very, very clearly and shows that compared to other states, depending on the measure, we're way below. And so the opportunity for us to respond is severely restricted unless we're funded at least the 100 million level. So I'm sorry, I had a wonderful story to tell you about being last night in the Self-Enhancement Incorporated up and talking to African-American students and having a huge crowd. The funding in the cells are something like $2,900 per cell. And if you look at the right-hand level, at the level 3, the numbers get to be $900, $700, or $1,200. The total number of student credit hours in all of OUS at Oregon State and level 3 is almost 40%. What that means is almost 40% of the student credit hours at level 3 at Oregon State. And so if you reduce the funding of the model even 10%, it's a reduction of maybe $2,900 at level 1. But as you just heard, at the top level, that is level 3, that's something like $1,000, $1,200 for every one of those students. And Oregon State can't stand a funding level less than $100 million. We have this year, this biennium, we have 1,000 more students, nearly 1,000 students who are not in the formula. Our projected increased freshman students next fall at this day is an additional 586 more students. And so Oregon State simply can't manage if it's not funded at the 100 million level just because we can't reduce those large cells because of the high cost of our programs. And we have 40% of those at Oregon State. You have to understand that. So it has a huge impact on Oregon State if it's not funded at the 100 million level. Second point is that Oregon State is, as a Carnegie One research university, it's the only one besides the University of Washington and all the Pacific Northwest. I can give you a very quick story why research funding from the state is important, and it turned out to be in the paper this morning that Representative Ross would have seen. It was a story about research at Oregon State, which has to do with reducing bone density in women. That project was funded by the federal government. The federal government did not fund, however, how to export that information around the state to help women who have this difficulty. It's a way of not only saving bone density mass, but actually increasing it. The university said that's such an important research result that it ought to be shared with hundreds or thousands of women, and so the university has invested money to make that set of results available in a program around the state. That's what's so important about research, and that's an example of why we need to have funding in this model for research. The third and last point I'll make is that when you think about businesses, businesses invest when they make changes, when they respond to new programs. These universities are trying to respond to new programs with funding which is below the national average, which is below the regional average. You have a sheet in front of you which lays that out very, very clearly and shows that compared to other states, depending on the measure, we're way below. And so the opportunity for us to respond is severely restricted unless we're funded at least the 100 million level. So I'm sorry, I had a wonderful story to tell you about being last night in the Self-Enhancement Incorporated up and talking to African-American students and having a huge crowd and all those sort of things. But those three technical points, you have to understand that less than 100 million, Oregon State is in severe jeopardy because of the very high proportion of high-quality programs and high-cost programs. That in terms of research, we have to fund research to make the research results available to the people of Oregon and elsewhere. And finally, we have to have enough maneuvering room so that we can respond to new needs. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon?
Thank you very much. And I would just like to say that I'm sorry that you don't have time to tell that wonderful story as well. I am very much aware, though, of the partnership that you have working with Self-Enhancement. I was sharing with Senator Tro on yesterday a couple of major news articles in the Scanner newspaper up in Portland that illustrates how hard the university is working to market its programs and to recruit and retain students of color. So I would just like to go on record as commending you for some really aggressive activities that are going to bear results. We're talking about students who are going to stay in our state, and we're not going to lose them to lose their talents to some other state. So more power to you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Gordy. I might observe that at the current time, our applications from underrepresented students are up 40%.
Any other questions? Any closing comments?
No, I think these folks make the case from the trenches are better than anything, including remarks I could make. The issue is recapitalizing the system that was severely damaged in the last decade. It is an opportunity, I think, to position us to best serve Oregon in the century comes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes,